Rich Kimble, Bruce Pratt, Kerry Haskell here, and it is time for this week's Sports Lit 101. We've had a chance to talk about this book a couple of times, but today we get to talk with the man who put it all together, a wonderful collection called Perfect Eloquence, an appreciation of Vin Scully, edited by Tom Hofarth, who joins us this afternoon. Tom, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We love the book, and if you're going to call a book Perfect Eloquence, then it can't be just the eloquence of Vin Scully that you talk about, but you managed to find so many different people who eloquently share their memories of Vin Scully.
Well, it's easy for me here living in Los Angeles to find 67 people, because it could have been 6,000, 6 million people. But it's amazing to me the reach he had, not just being the Los Angeles Dodgers broadcaster, but also, Major League Baseball and the NFL. A lot of people forget he did NFL games. He was just so good in golf with CBS and NBC. So here in Los Angeles, when he passed away in 2022, in August, we heard the news by watching a Dodger game. It's just the way it is, Dodgers-Giants games. And it just kind of struck me right away how I had known him for so long, and I wanted more people to know about what a great man he was and how he was so empathetic and humility and everything, these great, perfectly eloquent qualities he had about him. And I wanted to share that not just with the people in Los Angeles, but from around the country who had heard his broadcast. And this is kind of how it came together, and I'm so glad that you guys tracked it down.
Well, what I thought was really spectacular about this book is that people weren't just, it's great. You got Bob Costas, you got all kinds of famous people, but people that knew him in a way that would not normally put you in touch with that kind of a person that he stayed in contact with, he reached out to, he was always solicitous of how they were doing, from this, the guy that opens the door at the golf course to top-notch players. I think it was able to tell me who he was in a way I don't think any other kind of memoir or biography would have done.
Yeah, and that's the thing I was trying to figure out, too, as well as it. I didn't want to make it a biography because so many people known about him, but I needed some biographical material in there just as a timeline to have reference points. And I really didn't think about making it a tribute book because that would be everyone just kind of gushing over him, which is fine. I wanted it to be an appreciation book about people from all walks of life, like you said, who appreciated just the moment that he gave them at some point when he was walking down the street or he had a question or he needed a reference to something during his preparation for a game. And the fact that I could capture so many stories that were different, but so many were touched on so many similar things that made it so interesting, whether you were a famous actor or just a stadium operator. And I think what really pulled this together was learning more about his faith and his family and all those things that were so important to him. And the thing that he could give people most that nobody else could give was his time. And then what he did with that time, he made you the most important person in during a discussion or during a moment where we were having a discussion about, something, can you help me do this or can you research this for me? And in the 30 years that I covered him as a sports writer in Los Angeles, we had a lot of deeper discussions about things and found out, mostly football was his favorite sport. And you find out different things about him. Again, like I think you mentioned, applesauce being his favorite food and all these things that are just like you put him on this pedestal as the greatest broadcaster ever. But to me and to most people who knew him, he was just the greatest person ever. And that's in a time like this where we're having so many conflicts and negative comments and putting people down. And it's just the essence of being nice and friendly and available with your time is something that may be a lost art, but hopefully a book like this can kind of remind people that it still has a lot of value.
Well, yeah, and I think that's what came through to me. I mean, you only had to listen to know how brilliant he was as a broadcaster, but reading these stories, you realize that if it's possible, he was an even better, more decent and kind human being.
Absolutely, and I it's it's something that I hope is able to convey, like you said, and I hope it's something that people can share stories with, too. I've been working on a website where now that people are reading this, they'll say, hey, he sent me a note card when I asked him about this, or he sent me a thank you card, or he called somebody who was sick and just kind of lifted their spirits. And he was almost, you know, just kind of religious figure in some ways to some people. And there's all these things that we do in Los Angeles to pay tribute to people who've been made an impact here. And Kobe Bryant has all these statues and murals and things. But Vin Scully is catching up pretty quick as far as people who say, let's remember him as the greatest broadcaster of all time. But he gave the city, which is such a conglomeration of different smaller cities and populations and ethnic diversity, he gave this all a singular voice. And it's still a voice that resonates with me, and I just wanted to share a lot of the memories that I had, as well as setting up the chapters and then kind of name-checking a few people to see if, hey, did you have a similar experience? And they not only did, but they had a greater one.
One of the things I was struck by, and I did not know, I used to listen to WFUV all the time when I lived in southern New England, was his role in getting that station going. And it's a major player in New York. It's at Fordham University. Do you think the fact that he got into radio that early was in part why he loved radio so much? I mean, I know he did TV, but he always would talk about he loved doing baseball on the radio.
Yeah, the radio was really his medium. It was his storytelling platform. And it's what resonated with him as a child when he grew up, and he could sit underneath a giant radio in the living room and just listen to the crowd roar and just soak all that in and just know that when you're doing a broadcast, your job is to do, you know, the score, the time, the play, be accurate. And but then in baseball, you have this time to weave in stories. In golf, you can weave in stories. But it's also to let the crowd, let the person at home know that this is really an exciting moment. It's not your voice screaming louder than the crowd. It's letting the crowd drown you out. And in every famous call that Vin has, whether you were playing the Sandy Koufax perfect game or the Henry Aaron 715th home run or even the catch, Joe Montana, you know, in the NFC title game in 1982 to, why am I blanking on his name, the tight end. Anyway, Dwight Clark. So those moments are always there to preserve that thing that we're either watching, listening to. But his radio was really his perfect medium because it allowed him to control everything. As like you said, he was a singular voice, so he had the paints. He brought the paintbrushes in, and he could paint the time of day, the clouds, the weather, the colors on the field, and it just made him so much more, not only in control, but made it so personal. And he could talk directly to the listener and make them feel like they were just two guys sitting in a living room listening to a game or watching it. And that's why television was a great medium for him to be popular nationwide, but radio was really the key to them. And then there was a point in between working for different networks where he did the World Series with Sparky Anderson for CBS Radio so that everybody could hear it. And that's when, you know, you could really get him in his perfect element.
Well, I think what he did in 1989, and it's on the timeline at the beginning of the book, it says, Scully pulls off perhaps the most impressive single feat by a modern baseball broadcaster, calling 46 innings in 27 hours in two cities. I mean, and then he lets Drysdale get 13 innings off or whatever because his voice is ailing. But Scully keeps going. I can't imagine a broadcaster today, and there are many whom I respect, that would be able to do that or wouldn't just say, no, somebody else is going to have to fill in tomorrow because I'm only going to get 3 hours sleep.
Yeah, and it was a game in St. Louis with the Cardinals, and they had to fly back to the Dodgers and Astros in Houston. And I remember piecing that together when I was a kid listening to that, and I'm not really a kid, but just listening to how that all came about and then realizing there was, you could never tell he was fatigued or upset or frustrated with any of it. And he would just later say, that's my job. That's what I have to do. And it just worked out that way that he did all those innings because of the trip being in the same time zone and him able to come back you know, back in a lot of these days now, broadcasters will take the whole weekend off if they're a local broadcaster per team, if they have a national assignment. And in those days, you were right back with the team right away. And one of the things that he had always talked about when he covered golf for CBS, he would do the Masters. And they would, you know, the people in L.A. would say, did you ever get to play, you know, Augusta? Because he loved golf. He goes, no, after the round was over, I had to get back to my Dodger job. And and he knew that he had loyalty to the team. And, I mean, there was that time, too, when the Yankees came calling him in the early 60s as Mel Allen was retiring and said, you know, Vin, you're still a New Yorker. Do you want to come back and work for the Yankees? And he said, I have this loyalty now to the O'Malley family. And he had only been living in Los Angeles for 5 years. But he knew that he had become this soundtrack to Los Angeles through the power of the transistor radio. And this became his new town, and he started his family here and just became, you know, one of our most legendary sports figures ever.
We're talking with Tom Hofarth about perfect eloquence and appreciation of Vin Scully. One of my favorite stories in the book comes from a friend of our show who's been on several times, the wonderful actor Bryan Cranston.
Oh, yeah. Bryan grew up here in the San Fernando Valley and had a really troubled childhood with his parents. And Vin, to him, was always this blanket of comfort. And Bryan was so fortunate to stay in Los Angeles and work here and have the opportunity several times to meet Vin. I think his wife arranged for a visit on his birthday once. And then the ESPN ESPY Awards were in Los Angeles. And he in 2016, got to present Vin with a lifetime trophy. And there's just this beautiful picture of them walking off the stage, you know, with their arms around each other. And Bryan, it gets very emotional when talking about Vin, about how he kind of pulled him through a lot of hard times. And Bryan even wrote that in his own book recently, too. So it was to get people like that to kind of let their guard down and explain what Vin meant to them was so compelling and so sincere in getting this book pulled together and getting all these essays pulled together.
I was very moved by the story about Ray Charles wanting to meet Vin Scully. I mean, former musician, I revered Ray Charles, but the idea to me was that Ray Charles could see when he was young. He lost his sight when he was quite young. I'm just wondering if the ability for Vin Scully to paint a picture, and that's what he could do better than anybody, was what really appealed to Ray Charles, that he could see baseball again.
Well, one of the essays that I was able to recruit was from a Los Angeles Times columnist named Chris Erskine. And Chris had a sense of music as well, and he took Vin's tapes to a USC music department chair, and they ran him through the machines just to say, is there some melody into his voice that we can capture? And it really was like musical notes in the way his voice rose and dipped and emphasized. And so what you knew intuitively about his voice being music, it was, you know, signified by this research project. It was all justified. And I think Vin, back in growing up, wanted to be a song and dance man. He really loved musicals, and he would listen to musicals as he was driving into the games, and Oklahoma was a favorite one of his, and The Music Man, and so he loved Gene Kelly, and he loved Danny Kaye. Danny Kaye became one of his great friends, and Danny Kaye ended up being one of the owners of the Seattle Mariners, one of the first teams. So Vin had these connections to these people, and he just loved being around them and just kind of vicariously living through their careers while they wished that they could be the broadcaster that he was.
Yeah.
So he living in Hollywood too, you know, being accessible to movie roles and TV shows and all these things that he did, you know, he would have been this great broadcaster no matter what part of the country he worked in. But the fact that he was in Hollywood also sort of resonated in how his humility kind of came into play, how he says, oh, I'm not Hollywood. You know, they wanted me for different roles and things, and I just kind of loaned my voice to it. But if you get a chance to watch the movie For Love of the Game with Kevin Costner and listen to Vin describing Billy Chappell on the mound pitching for the Detroit Tigers, trying to pitch a perfect game at Yankee Stadium, that's as Vin is all ad-lib. They wrote a script for him, and he said, let me try it. Let me just watch some clips and try it. And then that's how it came out. So,
And it's the best part of that movie.
Yeah, just the music in his voice made everything so soothing. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, that is the best part of that movie. One of the things that I was so impressed by is the way he would call his wife 45 minutes before he went on the air. I mean, when I traveled as a musician, I'd always try and call my wife before the show and after the show, but
right.
45 minutes before, he's on the phone.
Well, because he had his day sort of planned out. He'd been with her during the day, and then he leaves for the game at 2 o'clock, he's got kids, and he wants to make sure she's you know, got things in control. Do you have the conversation really would be, you know, anything you need me to pick up? You know, what can I do? What's our plans for the next day? And he just had this great loving relationship with Sandy, who passed away about a year and a half before he did, and ironically of Lou Gehrig's disease. And he kind of watched her go through that process, and then he was taken care of by his daughters at his home and until he lived to be 94. But it was just a loving experience he had with his wife, and you would know if you were in the booth with him, he was going to duck out with his cell phone and give her a call and just see how she is. And she lovingly came to a lot of the games as well and just kind of sat in the press box while he was doing the games, just so he could be there. She could be there with him, and he could kind of, you know, enjoy their company. They just loved being in the same space together.
Well, I thought that your structure of making it 9 innings, you know, 9 groups of essays, was brilliant, because you found a way to make each inning connect, the essays in that connect, and that's a difficult task. I've edited some things, and that was really impressive to me. Was that an idea you had from the start, or did that sort of grow as you were assembling the essays?
Yeah, I think when I started piecing this together and trying to find qualities that made him resonate with me, it just landed on 9 as I kind of put it together. And the 9th one, I think, was really about how all these people had been influenced by him to get into broadcasting. And that was kind of an obvious thing, but I didn't really think about it. But that just kind of fell together, just like the fact that the 67 essays fell together, because I had no idea how many people I could get in a 3-month period to put this together, and 67 just landed on it, and that's just happened to be the number of years that he worked for the Dodgers. It's such a random number that I just felt like it was all this karma kind of coming together and making it happen as it was supposed to happen. So, you know, he loved numbers. He loved to say the deuces are wild when it was a 2-2 count and there were two runners on base and it was a 2-2 game or something like that. And so numbers were always fun to him, but he never relied on numbers like broadcasters do today, you know, statistics and things. He was much more about stories and hobbies that the players had. And he did it so much with just newspaper clippings through the years. He kept these scrapbooks and he just had this great memory. So one thing, he could see something and it would just trigger a memory and he would just tell that story. And so when you just sort of pulled it all together, the numbers just kind of added up the way they did. It was really kind of interesting.
Well, it is a wonderful read about, I think, a kind we'll never see again. We'll never see a connection between a town, a team, and a broadcaster like Vin Scully and the Dodgers. Tom, thank you so much for your great work and for being with us today to talk about it.
Oh, thank you, guys. You're so nice to read it and have great things to say about it. And I think Vin would be humbled by your thoughts as well, so as I am.
Well, it's been great to talk to you. I'm so glad that our friends at Nebraska sent this to me as soon as it was available, because it's a great, great book.
Well, thank you so much.
That's Tom Hofarth. The book is Perfect Eloquence and Appreciation of Vin Scully on Sports Lit 101.